Hello, everybody. This is Bill Knauer, and you're listening to Author, where we talk about writing and life, because what it takes to write the book you want to write is also what it takes to lead the life you want to lead. Author to Author is brought to you by Author Magazine, the premier free writing magazine on the internet, featuring articles on writing and the writing life, as well as video and audio interviews with best-selling and award-winning authors across those genres. You can find Author Magazine at authormagazine.org. And we are funded by the Pacific Northwest Writers Association, supporting writers from pen to publication since 1955. Excuse me. If you want to find out more about the PNWA, you can go to pnwa.org. That's .org. Well, let's get right to it, shall we? Today's guest is Paul Steinberg, MD. He's a psychiatrist. He's a writer, and just recently, or this April, as of this April, the author of the memoir, I guess you could call it a memoir, A Salamander's Tale, My Story of Regeneration, Surviving 30 years with prostate cancer. There's a lot we can talk about, so let's just dive right in. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be part of this.
You know, I was thinking about this. I normally sort of, just as a way of greeting, begin my shows by saying, how are you doing? But it strikes me that that's a question that you've probably heard a lot over the last 30 years. And there's a lot more meaning to it than just what we normally mean, which is just hello, basically.
Right.
How are you doing,
Paul?
I tried to avoid
that question as much as possible. I was doing well, but I really didn't want to talk about what was going on behind the scenes for 31 years. I'd prefer to talk about other things in life.
Well,
but I knew what people were getting at when they asked, how are you? And those very profound kinds of how are yous.
You know, I have a theory, Paul, about that. It just struck me as I was listening to you discuss how are you, that when we're going deep real fast. Are you ready? I just can't resist. This is what I'm
quite
do.
Ready. Sure.
I think when they ask you, they're really in a way talking about themselves, because the question they're at, what the question that they're asking about is death in a way, because the cancer was a part of your life. And in a way, it's got to be a person's own fear of death that hovers around that question and checking in with you, who's having to live with the threat of it in the way most of us don't. Does that make sense?
Sure, sure, absolutely. And at least they're asking the question. And certainly I met people along the way who were even too threatened by the question that they ended up avoiding me or my wife and
sure.
my family and didn't want to even ask that question, how are you?
Yeah. It's just too scary. So, all right. So let's the book, A Salamander's Tale, Story of Regeneration, 30 years living with prostate cancer. And I should say that the story begins in a way when doctors told you the chance of you seeing even 10 years were pretty slim. Isn't that right?
Very slim. It was about 40% that I'd be able to live 5 years, and about 10% that I'd be able to live 10 years. So it was pretty brutal. My kids were 4 and 6 years old at the time, and I just didn't think I'd see them at all into adolescence, let alone now significant adulthood. They're now in their mid to late 30s.
Yeah, and you were like 35 at that time, is that right? 30,
exactly, 30? Exactly.
Yeah.
35, turning 36. It took a while to get this diagnosed because I was so young that when I had a misshapen prostate, the urologist that I saw was the head of a major teaching hospital here in Washington. He said, well, the one thing we know is that it can't be prostate cancer. It cannot
right.
be that. It's got to be something esoteric, like some kind of tubercular prostate or something like that, but it turned out to indeed be prostate cancer.
And so they tell you you've got X number of years to live, and of course you're 35, and if you're anything like me at 35, although you're a smart man, you're a man who's read and lived and probably known people who have passed away, your own mortality was probably not a central issue in your life at that point, or maybe it was. But for most 35-year-olds, we're still
not at all. I thought I'd live a nice long life. My parents had lived nice long lives, family in general, uncles, aunts, grandparents, all living very healthily well into old age. So it didn't seem like a particularly significant problem until I might be 30 or 40 years older.
Yeah. And so then you get this news. So what do you do with that information? Because, I mean, the interesting part is you yourself are an MD. You're a psychiatrist, but you went through medical school. You were going to be an internist. Is that right? You were thinking about
with internal medicine and then went into psychiatry after a year of internal medicine and loved and still love the work that I'm doing.
Right. So you were a part of the medical profession. And what do you do when the medical profession, of which you are a part, tells you you're probably going to die? What do you do with that information? Because I'm not a doctor, and so I would be inclined to say, whatever. because that's how I am.
Realized very quickly through this whole process is that I had to recognize that I was a patient now, not a doctor, and I couldn't just simply do what I've been doing for the previous 15 years of my career, which was to act like a doctor and talk doctor talk to other doctors, because they were giving me information that was horribly scary and ultimately I realized incorrect, because it was based on data from 20, 30 years ago that was pretty static over the last 30 years as of 1984. And it didn't take into account that there are, as John Maynard Keynes, the economist, says, there are inventions that can come along. We don't know what those are, and we can't predict what's going to happen in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. I had to remind myself that, okay, maybe right now there is only a 10% chance that I'm going to live 10 years, but let me figure out what would allow me to be one of those 10% rather than the 90% that's going to die.
Right.
So I had to reframe it and think of it differently and figure out what are the particular things that I could do to protect my life and save my life.
Right. You had to become very optimistic. You were kind of required to look at the glass as 10% full, if need be, as opposed to 90% empty.
That's an interesting question, because I think there is a desire for all of us to look at things in a positive frame of mind, but you also want to look at it realistically. You don't want to be Pollyanna-ish and just say, oh, well, I know I'm going to be one of those 10%, but let me figure out, hey, there are some real problems here. The likelihood that I'm going to survive is actually pretty low, at least based on the statistics. Let me take that into account and not ignore that. So what can I do that might be different? And at least acknowledging the reality of the situation rather than putting my head in the sand.
Well, of course, one of the things that was recommended to you after you had some intense, was it chemo initially they did?
No, I initially did prostatectomy, a radical prostatectomy, that the surgery to the prostate bed, which is mutilative in itself. It's not a good area to start cutting around. As I point out in my book, the area of the body that has the second most nerve tissue in the entire body is the genital area, the prostate bed area. And that's why when women say men have their brains and their penises, they're much more than half right. It's an area that, we don't want our brain mutilated, and we certainly don't want our genital area mutilated by surgery. But so I had to deal with that. And then because the margins weren't clear with the tumor itself, there was evidence that there might have been some cells that had gotten beyond the prostate, I needed to go through radiation a few months after that. And that is not a good thing to, not a fun thing to do either in terms of just putting radiation into that area, which has already been severely damaged by the surgery. So had to deal with that. And so a good part of the first third of the book is really taking a look at what are some of the antidotes that I can use to actually get myself back into good sexual health. Get the that area humming along nicely, even though it's been surgically cut and also radiated.
Yeah, and of course, it got worse because not 5 or so years later, another doctor said, well, it's gotten worse, and so I've got another recommendation for you.
The PSA, which we now know, the prostate-specific antigen, was not available back in 1984, again, 31 years ago, when I had surgery. So nobody knew what kind of things might come along the pike. But in 1988 and 89, people in Buffalo, New York, were beginning to develop the PSA. And my surgeon up at Columbia Presbyterian Medical Center up in New York was one of the first users of it. So he called me and said, your PSA is up to 2.1, which we now know is still minimal. It's very microscopic disease. But he said, I got to, first of all, take you up here, and we got to start poking around in your genital area with surgical cut again and look if and see if we can find prostate cancer cells. Of course, it was a fool's errand. It's microscopic. Nobody would be able to see it. But because there was clear-cut evidence with the PSA rising, with the prostate having been removed, the PSA should be zero. There shouldn't be any antigen from the prostate that would develop. So, but nobody knew how to take a look at this and understand it and make sense of it. But the assumption back in 1989 was that I had metastatic disease, which was actually correct, but that the only thing that could be done was that I needed to go through permanent surgical castration. And I said, over my dead body.
That's an interesting choice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you were choosing between being able to create life and keep living yours, and you said, "Well, given the choice,
I wrote an article for Publishers Weekly where I said it was either give me libido or give me death.
It's so true, though.
Patrick Henry would have appreciated that.
Well, but so you did. You rejected the advice of it must have affected you, Paul, having been a patient in such a kind of permanent patient, and such a vulnerable one. You know, this is a life and death, and not just life and death, but your sexuality. Even while you are alive, even as you're being treated, it's dealing with your sexuality, couldn't be more personal. I would think it would have affected your relationship to your patients. How could it not? And either make you deeply bitter or more compassionate.
Well, I think it made me more compassionate. But initially, when I was first diagnosed and then dealing with the radiation treatment after the surgery, it was devastating to lose my sexual functioning. And I recall, I write this in the book about my experience. I was at the University of Maryland in College Park at that time as a psychiatrist working with students, and I ultimately went on to Georgetown University as a associate director, then the director of the psychiatric service for students. But at the time, back in 1985, right after coming back from surgery and then dealing with radiation, I was functioning okay, but within 3 or 4 months, when my whole genital area sort of died on me, I realized, man, this is just going to be terrible unless I do something about this. But it also affected my relationship with students. I was running groups, seeing people individually, and all I could think about was dead genital area. Dead pelvis,
which to you,
and
Which to you feels like, kind of, look, I'm going psychologist on you, but what does that, like, emotionally, what does that feel? Does that just end of creativity, end of potency, end of man? What does that feel like to you?
I thought it was end of potency, end of erectile functioning, and that was certainly what they had indicated was going to happen,
yeah.
That I'd probably get it back after surgery, but then the radiation would just destroy it further. But it was very fortunate that I discovered some remarkable antidotes along the way, Bill. For example, the Russians had been dealing with all sorts of radiation disasters long before Chernobyl. Back in the Ural Mountains in the 1950s, they had a major disaster that destroyed forests, whole areas of Russia. And subsequently, even when I was going through my radiation in 1984-85, they had just had a major problem along the Polish-Russian border. So I did some research on it. What did they do? Did they find some antidotes for their workers who were damaged through the radiation? And it turned out that hyperbaric oxygen, of all things, we think of it useful for the bends people who've been with carbon monoxide poisoning from suicide attempts. Hyperbaric oxygen does wonders, but it also turns out does wonders for radiation damage and radiation sickness. And I just had damage, but the hyperbaric oxygen did a remarkable thing. Then I also used acupuncture. So I often tell people, metaphorically, I ended up in Russia and China and various other places learning how to respond to the damage that the treatment, it saved my life, but the treatment certainly affected the quality of my life in a very profound way.
You know, it's interesting. You and I we touched on this briefly before the show started, but you write, and now I'm sure you do a lot of time, spend a lot of time talking about a subject that I think that if it were women would be talked about much more openly. But for men, except for a few Viagra and Cialis commercials, men do not talk about sexuality in this way and potency and erectile dysfunction and all the rest openly that much. But you do now. You're writing and you talk about it. And how has that gone?
Right. I think we men really have a lot to learn from women. Women are great at dealing with breast cancer, supporting each other, being open and forthcoming. We men, as I may have mentioned to you earlier, we men just lick our wounds very privately, very individually, and it's just not a good way to go because we don't get input from other people. And I figured as a psychiatrist, the one thing that I could do was just open up and talk to people and find out what might work well beyond anything that urologists might know about or oncologists might know about. And it certainly paid off. And also being a physician made a huge difference, too, in terms of being able to contact the best people in the world. So one of those best examples is the fact that when it was clear that everybody, the chorus from physicians in New York and elsewhere here in D.C. was that I needed to go through permanent surgical castration as soon as possible, immediately. I found a way to get in touch with a fellow named Gerald Murphy, who had helped develop the PSA, the prostate-specific antigen, several years earlier up in Roswell Park in Buffalo, New York. He was now at the CDC, the Center for Disease Control. I called him and somehow got a hold of him. And I told him my PSA is up to 2.1. Everybody's telling me I need to get the castration immediately, have my testicles removed. He started laughing. I didn't know what was going on. Is this guy a jerk? He said, I'm laughing only because the people around you are crazy. They're demanding things and asking things of you that don't make sense. We don't understand the PSA just yet, but I'll tell you, I've had people now with PSAs of 20, 100, several hundred, and they're still alive. They're still doing fine.
Wow.
A PSA of 2.1 is fine. Just go back to work. Help some people who really need help.
Oh,
you're
God.
One person who doesn't need help right now.
Wow. Wow. Did you run to those doctors who wanted to cut your balls off and say, listen, I feel like coming down there with a knife? to you guys. Did you talk to him, though, and say, you need to wake up? Did you talk to him about it? I would have been, if you're a doctor, I would have been inclined to do it.
Yeah, but it was everybody. I mean, the New England Journal of Medicine had articles after articles just indicating that the only treatment for metastatic disease was permanent castration, and the sooner you did it, the better. So these things become ideologies in a sense. And only a few years later, one of the doctors who told me I needed to go through castration, he became one of the people, the progenitors of the idea of this intermittent hormonal blockade, this intermittent chemical castration. So I was able, when I needed to, I could stay off treatment for at least another 2 years and let the PSA go up. And then when it went up far enough, I'd go on to a chemical castration, if you will, for about 6 to 8 months, and then off treatment for another year and a half and be back to being a sexual being. And I'll tell you, having three quarters of your life being a sexual being rather than zero part of your life being a sexual being makes a huge, huge difference. It's infinite, as the mathematicians would say.
Absolutely. And, you know, what I find fascinating about your career, Paul, is that if I read your biography, you've done all these wonderful things. You've worked with students. You've worked with athletes. I believe you've worked with some rock bands, taking your work and spreading it out in all different directions. You've done all this wonderful writing, most of which has been done while living with cancer, I assume. Most of this work has been done simultaneous with dealing with this cancer. And so how do you talk to me about the simultaneous experience of wanting a creative, sort of evolving life, both personally and professionally, and this unusual relationship to your mortality? Because most of us, I mean, I have never lived with a serious threat, at least not that I'm aware of, you know? And so how do you do those two things simultaneously?
Well, it's easier than you think. I mean, it's partly compartmentalization, but I found it very, very useful, especially when I was facing possible castration, since I'm a psychiatrist myself, to find an older psychiatrist that I had met previously who I could go see and talk about these things and just be able to put it into 1 hour a week, just focus on it that way, and the other 167 hours per week, I could just live a rich, full life. And it I found it extremely helpful to turn to someone else rather than turning to my wife, to my kids. And one of the things that my wife has always been impressed with is that really most of our friends, many of our family didn't know what we were coping with. We dealt with it ourselves. Our kids lived completely normal lives. It wasn't that we were trying to be in a state of denial, but we just wanted to live as fully as possible and not put any burden on the people around us.
Well, you know, and it makes sense, though, because if you're not going to die, if you're going to live, you might as well live, right? You don't want to live simply every day to not die, because that's not living anyway. So as long as you're here, but I would suppose it must have given you something, Paul, some perspective that might not have otherwise been available. Not just the cliche of I'm going to live life every day as if it were my last, but more of an awareness of being on purpose about your life. Is that
absolutely?
Do you think that came to you?
I haven't really talked about this to any extent, and didn't mention in the book. But in some ways, it's almost a little bit of survivor's guilt. You know, you're able to live. There are so many people with this disease and so many other horrible diseases who are going to die very prematurely. And as long as I'm living, and I'm living quite fully, I'm going to make the most of it. And ultimately, I put a lot of energies into writing. An editor at the New York York Times loved my pieces, so I was able to get a number of pieces published in the New York Times. I've been a frequent contributor there, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the International Herald Tribune. So it's been extraordinarily gratifying to just have the opportunity to realize, first of all, I have so much knowledge of the world, in a sense, that most people don't have. I mean, it's one thing if you have some terrible disease, pancreatic cancer, colon cancer, and you die within a 2 or 3 years after the initial diagnosis. But if you have 30 years, 31 years now, post the original diagnosis, boy, there's just a knowledge. It's not even palpable knowledge. It's just a way of thinking about the world that is really quite unique. And I think I'm able to present that in the book in a really significant way.
But it must help you in your work too, in helping
people
deal with their challenges.
Yeah, as I point out in talking about the book, every one of us, if we live long enough, is going to be dealing with some terrible blow, some terrible loss, some terrible set of circumstances that we couldn't have predicted. And I've been there, done that, and in that way I can deal with and help people who are struggling with some kind of blow, some kind of loss, and so many of us are facing those kinds of things.
You know what I think is would be so valuable about it? I teach writers a lot, and often the big blow for writers is dealing with a lot of rejection and a lot of disappointment, and I've had more than my share. And what helps me when I talk to my students is understanding how you really can recover from it. I know it's on a much smaller scale than having cancer, but it's still this thing happens. It feels devastating, and I know experientially there is, you know, a light at the end of the tunnel. And so I would think it would be helpful for you that it isn't just Pollyanna, as you say. It is, you have had the experience of moving on, of regenerating in a number of ways. And so you can speak with the authority of experience as opposed to simply, I guess, hope alone.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Exactly. And to put it in perspective, to realize, okay, you've gotten 3 or 4 rejections about your novel or your whatever you're writing. Let's look at it in a reframing kind of way to realize if it takes 10 or 20 times to get rejection before you get the approval, just reframing it. So if you get 10 rejections, geez, I only got 10 more left. Let me keep going. To just really have a different perspective on these losses and rejections and blows that any of us face in life.
Perception, I'll tell you, the longer I live, and it has been a relatively long time at this point, but the longer I live, the more I think perception is everything in a way.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes the framework for my entire existence, really. Perception,
right.
And which is always so mutable in a way.
Yeah. And we all, if we live long enough, have different kinds of perceptions from different traumas, different elements, different experiences in our life. And that's what makes horse races, as it were. It makes it very, very interesting and very complicated when you're dealing with 50, 60, and 70-year-old somethings.
Yeah. Well, Paul, you're a very interesting guy. I could talk to you for a long time, but we're coming to the end of our half hour together. But as you mentioned, you've done a lot of writing. This is your first book, is it not?
It's my first book.
Okay.
And by the way,
thank
you. And it's gotten some really good reviews. And one reviewer said it celebrates life in a way that's at once raw, funny, profane, and uplifting. And I just love those adjectives, raw, funny, profane, and uplifting. And as I told my wife and told some friends, it's not just a description of the book, but it's really a description of me.
Excellent. That means you were true, Paul. That means you wrote from your heart.
Well,
excellent.
My African-American friends tell me I really keep it 100. So that felt like a great review in itself.
All right. Well, so then you can answer this question for me. Finish this sentence for me. If writing has taught me anything, it's taught me What? What has it taught you, Paul?
It's taught me that when I actually sit down and write, I come up with some ideas that have been hashing around in my head, but they really become much more clear-cut and defined. And I find it an incredibly valuable task in its own right, not just talking to people, but writing, because it allows one to just get into a different perspective, as you use that word, perspective, a different way of thinking, and gives you some new ideas that seem different and interesting compared to what you might see in the conventional kind of writing that one reads.
That's excellent. Well, Paul, congratulations on being alive still with us and still doing stuff and writing books. And congratulations on this book. I hope you got more in you where that came from.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to doing more stuff. I've got some great ideas that I'm letting percolate. And Bill, I just want to thank you so much for allowing me to be part of this this discussion.
Oh, it was my pleasure. You brought a lot to the discussion, Paul. And so the book is out there wherever fine books are sold, The Salamander's Tale.
It's sold everywhere, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, every independent bookstore that I know of. It's out there everywhere.
Excellent. Okay, well, best of luck, Paul. Take it easy, and thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. Take care.
You bet. Give yourself a different perspective, people. Writing, you think you know. Writers don't know what they know until they write it. It's true of all of us, I think. And so let yourself go to the page. Let yourself open up and see what new thing will come. You never know. You never know indeed. Now, next week, I'll be here again, same time as always, with Gabriel Myers. Until then, go write something you love. It'll change when you write it, and you'll love it even more. It's true.